God bless you, and welcome to Spirit and Truth Fellowship International's audio podcast. Our goal is to provide you with Bible-based teachings that will help you walk in a transforming relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. We hope you will be inspired by what you're about to hear.
Well, welcome to this teaching. My name is Dan Gallagher, and I am going to be talking about the topic of prudence. In fact, the title of this teaching is Prudence, Learning to Do the Next Right Thing. Most people, admittedly, really don't put too much time thinking about the idea of prudence. In fact, the word prudence is really not used commonly nowadays. But yet, nevertheless, God tells us many times in His Word that we are to be prudent. Now, for years, I had thought that prudence was just synonymous with wisdom. And in reality, a prudent person is a wise person. But prudence is almost, if you will, a subset of wisdom. It has very distinct characteristics and facets that we need to explore and understand. Prudence is what helps us navigate through life when we reach critical points of decision. Because the phrase, just do the next right thing, actually is a really good, simple definition of prudence. I first heard that phrase a number of years ago from a coworker of mine when we were in a situation in the home office of Spirit and Truth Fellowship. I don't even know what the circumstances were or what it was that we were being faced with, but we had to make a decision. As we were kind of bantering back and forth and weighing the pros and cons, and he relayed the story of a minister that he knew and how the man once said that he had really learned that in times like that, what you need to do is focus on doing just the next right thing. With the emphasis that I'm putting on the next right thing. Many times in life, when we reach those critical points of decision, our mind, like a rabbit, wants to run off with all the what-ifs and the maybes. It's almost as if the problem at hand mushrooms into a much bigger problem because we begin to run all of these different scenarios through our head. What we really need to do is another friend of mine has helped teach me we need to anchor ourselves in our present reality. What is the situation at hand? And in that, then we need to decide what is the next right thing. What's the one next step we need to make? See, that really is the art of prudence. And in this teaching, I want to take the time to explore this because, just for instance, think about your life and all the choices you make. Now, I believe that we make hundreds, if not thousands, of choices every day. And certainly, most of those choices are minor and without consequence. But we all reach those times of decision where they're very critical. Do we go straight? Do we go left? Do we go to the right? Do we stop? For instance, what about choices concerning your career path? Do you go to school and pursue a degree? Or do you go to a trade school? Or do you do something else? Or even if you're in a job, do you stay with that job? Do you go for a promotion? Do you seek employment with a competitor or another company? These are things that face us every day. We can add to this, you know, just think about relationship problems. Over the years, I've had lots of relationship problems. And I've realized as I've looked back about it, many of those were a result of my own error, my own mistakes, and not doing the prudent thing. Or finances. If you just made right choices concerning finances, how different would your life be right now? Someone told me years ago, they said, if I had a choice or could have one thing, I'd like to always be right. And I thought about that. We discussed it, kind of laughed because most of us think we are right. But the example he used is just think about how if every time you spent money, you spent it properly. In other words, you are not tempted by the impulse buying that the stores put you through as you try to navigate to buy the milk at the back of the store. You've got to walk past all the other items on the shelves. In fact, there's an entire science that's devoted to shelf placement of products because they're trying to manipulate us to get us separated from our money. What would your life be if every item you purchased was a proper purchase for the right reason in the right way at the right time? Your life would be drastically different. I'm sure that many of us would have a lot more in savings, if not double, triple, or even quadruple the amount that we had saved. See, this is the discipline or the art of prudence. And in this teaching, that's what I want to take the time to develop. First of all, what is prudence? Let's look at it from God's perspective. And also, in knowing what it is, we have to be very clear what it is not. I want to take the time to look at some biblical examples of prudence, because over the years, I've learned that one of the best ways to learn prudence is through experience. It doesn't have to be your own personal experience, although it can be. It can be the experience of others. We can learn prudence through stories, with stories of people who have made prudent choices. And then in the second part of this teaching, I want to focus on some practical aspects of prudence. What are some of the obstacles that I believe the devil sets in our path so that we are not prudent people? And then what can we do to increase or gain more prudence in our lives? No one intentionally sets out in life to fail. And yet many of us do make mistakes and we do fail in certain areas. If we can learn the skill or virtue of prudence, then we can avoid many of the pitfalls of life. I believe that's what God wants us to do. Welcome now to part one of this teaching. And in this part of the teaching, I'm going to focus on what is prudence. As I mentioned previously, I've always thought of prudence as merely just being synonymous with wisdom. And in fact, prudence is a subset of wisdom, but it has some very specific characteristics which kind of help amplify or clarify and make distinctions between it and wisdom in general. In the Webster's 1828 dictionary, a dictionary that I like to refer to because we can go back to a more archaic meaning of words. Nowadays, words can change and they've lost some of their original sense. But in the Webster's 1828 dictionary, prudence actually is defined as practically wise. It's not just wisdom in a sense of knowing, but it's a wisdom in doing. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 1, and I'm going to start in verse 1. And if you have a Bible as you're turning there, I'm going to continue speaking here. In Proverbs, God gives us the definition of wisdom. I was kind of surprised a few weeks ago as I had an audience, and I asked in general, can someone give me the definition, God's definition of wisdom? Well, no one could. And see, that's a remarkable thing, because as I mentioned again previously, we've put all this emphasis on faith, but yet God tells us wisdom is supreme. And here we are as members of the body of Christ, followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, trying to do what God tells us to do. He tells us wisdom is supreme, and nobody could even define what wisdom is according to God, how God defines it. And it's very simple here in Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Verse 1 says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for attaining wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of insight." So these proverbs that Solomon has written down are to help us to attain wisdom and discipline, for gaining understanding and words of insight. And then it goes in verse 3, "For acquiring a disciplined and prudent life." See, there's our first usage of prudence here. "Doing what is right, just, and fair." God defines wisdom as doing what is right, what is just, and fair. And then verse 4 goes on, "For giving prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young." I mentioned previously that prudence is a form of wisdom, but it does differ from wisdom. In Hebrew, the word wisdom is chokma, and it means to understand, to perceive. Whereas prudence is the Hebrew word orma, and it is actually wisdom in practice. Practically wise. It's being wise and actually doing wise things. Proverbs chapter 2, verse 6 through 9 gives us a little bit more clarification on what it is to be wise. In verse 6, it says, "For the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He holds victory in store for the upright. He is a shield to those whose walk is blameless." Verse 8, "He guards the course of the just and protects the way of his faithful ones. Then you will understand what is right, just, and fair, every good path." So the good path is the right path, it's a just path, and it's a fair path. And in Proverbs 1, God says that wisdom basically is doing what is right, what is just, and what is fair. Remember earlier I said that we needed to do just the next right thing? That's prudence. See, prudence, to do the right thing, would be the right thing, the just thing, the fair thing. It's the good path. Prudence is what actually brings us to that point of being able to do the next right thing. Now, there's many aspects to prudence, and we're going to explore those. But it is not just a knowing what is the wise thing to do. It actually involves the doing. I mentioned previously that prudence is misunderstood and little used. Well, let's get clear what prudence is not. As I've mentioned, it's not a term often used today, so there's very little understanding about it. Most people, if you speak of a prudent person, they would think of that as someone that's ultra-conservative. Maybe even in the common vernacular, they describe it as someone who's a nerd. That is not prudent. Another thing that the word prudent has been degraded to is the word prude. You know, most of us are familiar with someone. If you call someone a prude, what do you mean? Well, it means that they're extremely modest, especially in sexual areas or sexual matters. That's what a prude is. But really, that's a degradation of the word prudent. Another thing that a prudent person would be maybe commonly thought of as someone who always plays it safe. And again, that's not necessarily true. I heard a story recently where a mother asked her son, you know, that he was going off to do something, and she said, "Is it safe what you're doing?" And he looked at her and he said, "Mother, it's not safe. It's not as in without risk, but the risk is acceptable." See, the prudent person is not someone who always plays it safe, but it's a person who has evaluated the risk and determined that it's acceptable. The prudent person actually is someone who knows what is the right thing to do in the right way at the right time for the right reason. That is prudence. That's why I say it's just doing the next right thing. Let me repeat that. Prudence is wisdom in practice. It is the right thing to do in the right way at the right time for the right reason. Prudence requires that we be circumspect. When I say circumspect, what I mean is that we have the ability to see all of the circumstances around us. You know, to be circumspect, if you think of circumference, that is, what is the area around? It's the outside limits of a circle. Well, to be circumspect, spect as in seeing, means to see everything around you. You're able to see all of the conditions, the facts, the circumstances. To be prudent also requires logic and reasoning. It requires sound and critical thinking, things that must be developed in us. A prudent person also has developed the ability of foresight. That is, the ability to predict outcomes from actions. So in other words, if I do this, then this most likely will occur. If we do that, then these are the possibilities. Prudence also includes an aspect of precaution, meaning that you recognize the hazards, that it's not that you're an overly cautious person, but that you recognize that even good choices can hide sometimes bad outcomes. Prudence requires discernment, and it is always involves a doing. It's the ability to discern the right, fair, just, and good path. The good path is always the morally upright path. Remember, I'm speaking of prudence the way God defines it. And for it to be the good path, the right, fair, and just path, it is always the morally upright path. Previously, I used the example and asked the question, what would it be like for your life if you always made the right choice concerning finances? Now think about that for a minute. What would your life be like if you always made the right relationship choices and all the other things that we get confronted with? I'm not trying to say that we could ever, you know, have that capacity, but if we will increase in prudence, then I can guarantee you we can decrease mistakes in our lives. We can decrease the problems that happen, and we'll be able to discern what is the best, the right, the fair, the just, the good path. Look at Proverbs chapter 3. This is why I think God says this is such a valuable thing that we have to gain. Proverbs 3:13 says, "Blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She's more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways. Her paths are peace. She's a tree of life to those who embrace her. Those who lay hold of her will be blessed." I believe that is a description of the life of a prudent person, that your life will be blessed, you'll know pleasant ways, your paths will be peaceful. Why? Because you're not doing the unwise thing. You're making prudent choices and you're following through and doing them. You're being circumspect, you're using reason and logic, you're able to have foresight concerning the prediction of consequences, and you're walking with caution. Something else that we have to understand concerning prudence is that it is a virtue. It's a governing virtue. What is virtue? Well, virtue is defined as moral goodness. It's moral uprightness. So in Proverbs, where God tells us that wisdom is knowing every right, fair, and just path, the good path, prudence is what allows us to discern it and follow through and do it. Remember, it's being practically wise. It's the exercising of wisdom. Virtues are things such as honesty, courage, loyalty, hope, kindness. You know, now when you think of honesty, most people would say, well, yeah, certainly honesty is a good thing. But prudence is a governing virtue because it tells us when we should be honest and when we should be not, and when we should not be honest. For instance, if you know an evil person comes to your front door, puts a gun to your head, and then says, "Tell me, is there anyone else in the house because I want to kill them?" You know, do you have an obligation to be honest in that situation? Of course not. Prudence is the quality, the virtue that tells us in that situation you should not be honest. Or how about people that come, and I've had experience where people say very mean and hurtful things, and then they say, "Well, I'm just trying to be honest with you, bro." You know, my reaction is, "Gee, thanks for sharing. I wish you'd kept that one to yourself." You know, see, prudence is what dictates to us. It's a governing virtue. It helps us to determine if, you know, what is the right way to be honest. Remember, it's doing the right thing in the right way for the right reason. And it's doing the next right thing. And so certainly there may be times where we need to confront. But, you know, a lot of people, they just want to live like, well, honesty, that's a virtue. So I'll be honest all the time. No, prudence is what helps to govern the other virtues. Let me give you an example of another one. I mentioned courage. Courage, I would say, is a good thing. Most of us would all think that courage is a good thing. But if courage is not governed properly, it can show up as recklessness. Or if there's too little of it, it becomes cowardice. See, it's prudence which tells us how to be courageous in the right way, at the right time, for the right reason. In the same way, loyalty. You know, every one of us desires to be loyal and have people that are loyal to us. But the fact is, you can be loyal to the wrong thing or the wrong person, and your loyalty can show up in the wrong way. You know, as I always think of, even pirates are loyal to each other. Or hope. You know, we would all think hope is a good thing, but hoping for the wrong things is not good. It's prudence which is going to dictate the thing that we should hope for and how that hope should show up. As a side note, you know, governing virtues like goodness or love, they cannot be pressed like courage could to become reckless or to become cowardice. Governing virtues are always upright. They're always perfectly in alignment with God. That's why love, you can have too little love, but love can never be a bad thing. Prudence can, in the same way, can never be negative. You may have too little of prudence, but prudence can never be a bad thing. I'd like to take some time now and look at some of the biblical lessons that God gives us on prudence. To do that, what we're going to have to do is to spend a lot of time here in Proverbs, because that's primarily where the word prudent or prudence shows up. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 16 says, "A fool shows his annoyance at once, but a prudent man overlooks an insult." Now, we all have a natural tendency, an instinctive, hardwired emotion of anger. But when governed by prudence, it helps us to know when to be angry in the right way, at the right time, for the right reason, at the right person or thing. See, a prudent man overlooks an insult. So in this case, there's a governing virtue of prudent, and it's helping to determine when should this insult be overlooked. And that's where God says, you know, a prudent person just doesn't pay attention to many of the insults. And really, that's a huge lesson for me. So many times in life, I've gotten myself in trouble because someone says something or writes something that's offending, and then I respond. But a prudent man, you know, someone who has this virtue, governing virtue of prudence, you know, they overlook the insult. In Proverbs 12:23, it says, "A prudent man keeps his knowledge to himself, but the heart of fools blurts out folly." Again, there's that lesson of honesty. You know, I think of that old song, "The Gambler" by Kenny Rogers. You know when to hold them and know when to fold them. You know, it's to be prudent. In Proverbs 12:23, it says, "The prudent man keeps his knowledge to himself." Now, that requires discipline. You know, so many times we know something and then we think that we need to share it. Well, a prudent person knows when to share and when not to share. And, you know, just even the fact that God is connecting prudence with knowledge implies that there's an art to critical thinking and logic and reasoning. Proverbs 3:16 says, "Every prudent man acts out of knowledge." Again, there's that critical thinking. You're acting out of knowledge. And also, that can imply the concept of being circumspect, to look at all the details and all the aspects that are surrounding the situation. That's what a prudent person does. He doesn't just take part of the information and then run off. So many times, I've seen that, I've done it myself, where I come to a judgment or, you know, come to a decision on something, and then only to find out that, wow, I really didn't have all the facts there. See, that's how we make mistakes. That's how we err. But if we are a prudent person, we'll take the time, gather the facts, look at all the situation, and then act out of knowledge, as Proverbs 13:16 says. Proverbs 14:8 says, "The wisdom of the prudent is to give thought to their ways, but the folly of fools is deception." A prudent person is someone who sits back and thinks and reasons about what's going on. You learn from your own experiences. You're not afraid of making mistakes. Rather, you know that when you make a mistake, you're going to learn from that, and then you're going to press forward. I did an entire teaching called Failing Forward a number of years ago, and that's part of being prudent. As a prudent person is someone who learns from your experience, both yours, and you can learn from the experience of others. And then you exercise insight, reasoning, and learning. That's why it says in Proverbs 14:8, "The wisdom of the prudent is to give thought to their ways, but the folly of fools is deception." And then also Proverbs 22:3 says, "A prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. A prudent person, what is it that God's talking about here? That's foresight. To be able to see danger and take refuge means that you have the ability to predict consequences, to predict outcomes. Now, certainly things don't always go the way that we predict, but a prudent person is someone who is circumspect. They've looked at all the circumstances, all the facts. They've exercised insight, reasoning, and learning. They've looked at all the different possibilities. What are all the options? And then they've exercised foresight. They see the danger that's coming, and then they take refuge. They exercise foresight. They see consequences and predict outcomes. This is why prudence is so important, and we must learn it, because it's imperative that we learn how to walk on the right, the fair, and the just path, and that will always be the good path, and it will always bring us great peace and success in life. Well, now I'd like to welcome you to part two of this teaching, and in this part of the teaching, I want to explore things that prevent us from developing prudence, and what we can do to increase prudence in our life. So first of all, things that prevent us from developing prudence. I would like to say, as I begin this section, that it was recently when I was actually traveling on an airplane, where I read a small article in one of the magazines, and there was a question posed to a man by the name of John Bradshaw. Now, I have since learned that John is a very famous counselor. I think he's, well, I know he's got his PhD, although I'm not sure in what, possibly psychology or something. But the question was put to him, what is the most important thing that people need nowadays? And he said, the most important thing is practical wisdom, which is known as prudence. Well, that set me off on this journey, and I since have gotten a book by John called Reclaiming Virtue. Now, it's a very deep read. It's a pretty thick book. But many of the things that he said, I found phenomenal and very insightful. It was John Bradshaw that showed me that prudence actually is a governing virtue. What that means is, if it's to govern something, then it's imperative that you have other virtues in your life. So prudence can't really oversee honesty if I haven't taken the time to be an honest person. Now think about this for a minute. A person is not considered honest in the sense of being an honest person just because I'm honest today. No, that just makes me honest in the moment. An honest person is someone who has taken the time and is honest over a long period of time. They've developed the virtue of prudence. Prudence is always doing the virtuous thing. As I said previously, it's the right thing in the right way for the right reason, always at the right time. The devil comes along and sets up an attack against us to prevent us from developing virtue. Of course, that's no surprise. You know, the things that are upright, the things that are morally good, the things that are kind and peaceful, well, the devil doesn't want us to develop those things in our lives. So how does he go about preventing us from developing virtue? One of the things we need to understand is that babies do not come into this world as little blobs. In fact, there was a short television thing I saw on the internet. Good friend of mine, Jane Bickle, sent it to me, and it was on babies. Well, Jane and I fellowshiped together for years, so she knows, you know, how my mind works. And, you know, she found that this was very interesting because, again, I'm always looking at how is the devil derailing people? What is it that's going on? In this show on 60 Minutes, what they said a number of very profound things, but at one time, they actually thought that babies came into this world as just little blobs of nothing. There was a philosopher named Philip Rousseau, and he actually said that babies are perfect idiots knowing nothing. Now, the fact of the matter is, we have since learned that that's not true. And in John Bradshaw's book on Reclaiming Virtue, he, in other ways, has very clearly demonstrated that we come into this world actually hardwired. We have an operating system embedded right into us when we enter into this world. Babies actually demonstrate preferences and they are biased towards goodness and kindness. Studies have actually shown that they can differentiate good from evil. Now, I'm not going to get into all the parameters of the show and stuff, but that's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it, that we come into this world biased towards goodness and kindness. Actually was an article in the Nature magazine of 2007 that developed that whole train of thought. And one scientist even stated that babies can't even walk, talk, or even crawl, yet they come into this world with a universal moral code. Now, this is groundbreaking. I mean, that almost blows apart evolutionary thinking in some ways. It's a complete confirmation of God's word, which should be no surprise because that's really what true science should do. It should always end up with a confirmation of what God has already told us is true in the beginning. But in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." We are actually hardwired. It's our operating system right from birth to be biased towards goodness and kindness and to actually have innate things that are wired right into us. What are some of these innate, programs? I kind of hate to use the word instinctive things, because in some ways they are. For instance, we are all hardwired for joy. God designed all mankind so that we would recognize joy. Another thing that we are hardwired for is interest. You know, there are things that just grab our interest. And a third one is fear. And another one is anger and surprise. Now, think of surprise for a minute. If you take a little baby, and we've all done this, where a person puts their hands over their face and then does peekaboo. And you go to the baby, you go, and you move your hands, and you go, boo. And the little baby, what do? They all giggle and smile. And if you do it gently, you don't do it, too shockingly, and they all giggle. Because what you've done is you've triggered the surprise response with the joy response. It's almost as if they recognize the face, but it disappeared. They can't think cognitively like, where'd you go? All of a sudden you're there, or you're gone with your hands over your face, and then you appear. And that triggers the joy response. Now, what the devil does is he comes and he takes these hardwired programs and he pushes them to evil. He'll take the surprise response and he'll make it an extreme form of surprise, which we would call being startled. Or he takes the fear response. We all have fear. It's innately wired into us because we should have a healthy fear of things that could harm us. You know, put a baby on a table and they instinctively, don't want to, they have a fear of falling. But what the devil does is he takes fear, maximizes it, almost puts fear on steroids and creates terror. Now, if you think about this, just think of a common horror movie. I always think of the movie Jaws, because we have another innate hardwired thing called distress. We are hardwired to recognize when things are just not quite right. It causes us distress. Well, what the devil does is he takes the distress response and he triggers it with music. So remember the Jaws movies where the music where it goes dun 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 dun, and it just builds this angst inside. In fact, all of the horror movies maximize the distress response, which they do through music. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes the big shark jumping out of the water, or the hatchet coming out of the blackness, or a chainsaw. The devil's triggering the surprise response, but he's doing it in a way which causes an extreme startle. So what the devil does is he pushes distress to anguish, surprise to startle. He takes fear and he presses it to terror. And this is constantly what he's bombarding us with. Now, the reason I'm going into length on this is because this is how he derails us from developing virtue. He presses the joy response. We all seek to be joyful, and he presses the joy response to an extreme form of pleasure called lust. Remember, I said that prudence is a governing virtue, meaning you must have developed the underlying virtues for it to govern. What the devil does is he derails us so we never develop the underlying virtue, because virtue takes time. The only way that you can become virtuous is by practicing virtue. The devil, the father of lies, which John 8:44 says, where Jesus confronted the Pharisees and he's speaking to the devil, he says he's a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth. There's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he's a liar and the father of lies. That's what the devil does. He manipulates the basic desires of the human heart. And he, knowing that we seek joy and we have a joy response, what he does is he basically short circuits us so we never take the time to develop virtue. You cannot be a prudent person without having developed virtue in your life. I think of my own self. For instance, let me just use the example of sobriety, that it's pleasurable to me to drink a beer or to have a glass of wine. And, you know, that's pleasurable. And in fact, you know, when you do, if you drink, you know, the more you drink, you'll get a sense of euphoria, which we call intoxication. Now, to be intoxicated is an extreme form of having a buzz from alcohol. Well, nobody would drink alcohol if there wasn't some sense of pleasure derived from it. And that's what the devil's doing. He lures us so that there's underlying reasons, but a person drinks mostly, someone who's, I'll say, alcoholic, is trying to numb out the pain in their lives, which the father of lies has caused. And so they seek some form of pleasure and joy, but it becomes a response of lust, which is really just extreme pleasure. And that's what the devil does. So we go for the immediate joy, whereas if we didn't, you know, the alcoholic goes for that immediate drink, whereas if he just didn't drink, really sobriety and temperance have their own reward. There's a great sense of satisfaction from being a sober person. But someone who's been tempted in the field of alcohol, they never get to the point where they get to experience that joy. The same thing happens in all of these areas of life. You know, just consider sexual immorality, that a person goes for the immediate pleasure, whereas chastity or being a person chaste in a pure in the area of sexuality, that has its own reward. You know, the longer you're honest, the more joy you get out of just being an honest person. But this is where the devil derails us. He comes along, throws these you know, immediate sense of reward in our face. We go for it. The end result is people never develop the long-term joy that can come from the virtue of, say, sobriety or temperance or chastity or you know, many of the others. Why does a person lie? And I was thinking about this the other day. I posed the question to those in my fellowship. You know, why does a person lie? I don't think a person lies just because they want to lie. I think a person lies because they're trying to either, you know, they want to feel good about themselves by portraying a false image. Maybe they're lying about making themselves look bigger than they really are. Or maybe they're lying because they don't want to feel bad about themselves. They don't want you to know the truth of what they've done or who they really are. It's not that, you know, it's just a lying in and of itself. It's a lie because you're trying to find joy. Whereas if a person didn't lie and they were just honest, then they get that same sense of joy, but it takes a lot longer to develop that. It takes a long time to develop virtue. And that's the point. Prudence must be developed. It's in the same way, virtues must be developed. It doesn't come naturally. And we can only become a prudent person when we've taken the time to develop the underlying virtues. Now, I'm not sitting here pretending in any way, sense, or shape of it that this is an easy thing to do. You know, the fact is that if you've got an area in your life that you're not being virtuous, that you need to conquer, then you need to start in small steps. And there's lots of things we can do. But the devil, what I'm trying to point out here is the devil is consciously going about trying to set up things in our lives to prevent us from being virtuous. You know, this may be one that touches a raw nerve, but, you know, even overeating. I love sweets, you know, and I can overeat to my own detriment. You know, when I eat sweets and eat sugars, it's been proven it's not healthy for us. Why do I do that? I go for the immediate pleasure that I'm derived from it. Whereas if I would take the discipline to not eat that, eventually over time, it has its own reward because I sit back and go, I'm in control. But see, that takes a long time to develop a virtue of control over a tendency to eat sweets like that. But this is why, too, in Proverbs chapter 1, if you will recall and go back and think about that, always connected to prudence is discipline. You cannot be a prudent person without developing discipline. And that's where the devil attacks us, and that's how he gets us to derail us from being prudent. So now, that leads us to the logical question, well, how do you increase prudence in your life? I've discovered in my own life there's a couple ways. First of all, since prudence is overseeing virtue, you have to have what I like to call as moral intelligence or intelligence concerning virtue. You've got to know what virtue is, what are the right things to do. And then you've got to build those in your mind. We can learn from examples, in our own lives and the examples of others. For instance, let's go to the story of Joseph. That's in Genesis chapter 37, verse 3. And as you're turning there, we can learn from so many biblical characters the concept of prudence and virtue. It says in Genesis 37, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word of him." I first of all think about this as I look at Israel here. You know, it's like, well, that certainly wasn't prudent to be able to demonstrate, you know, greater love and affection for Joseph than the rest of the brothers. So, you know, there seems to be an initial setup for envy and jealousy here. But in verse 5, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. What jumps off me in that is, that was a stupid thing to do, Joseph. What are you thinking? I mean, is that prudent just because God gives you a dream that you're going to go repeat this dream to all of your brothers who are already having a problem with you? Well, that when I read that reminded me of an experience I had a number of years ago where God communicated to me very clearly in a series of three powerful images that I believe he prophetically spoke to me. Well, what did I do with that? Well, I turned around and ran off and I spoke that. And you know what it did? It didn't solve a thing. Caused me nothing but grief and heartache. The fact is that what God spoke did come to pass. But he never did tell me that I needed to go running around and blabbing about it. I was seeking God's help and seeking, you know, kind of a reassurance like, God, what's going to happen here? And he spoke to me and he told me. It was for my own benefit, but because of my own lack of prudence, I blabbed it out. And the truth of the matter is, as I've thought about it, it was my own ego. You know, it was my own, you know, oh, God spoke to me probably somewhere deep in my motives of my heart somewhere. And I read this and I can completely relate to Joseph. Man, my point rehearsing this story is, see, you know, I can learn by reading what Joseph did, compare that to my own life, and then go, wow, I'm going to really try and not do that again. And I've increased in prudence. And then it goes on and it says, You know, we've got the story of Joseph and how he is taken off and sold into Egypt. But then it goes on and it talks about how, you know, he's sold and he becomes a servant in the household of Potiphar. And how, you know, he rises up in Potiphar's house. And it says in verse 6, so he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. I mean, that's because Joseph was a prudent person. He was demonstrating practical wisdom. Then we also know that Joseph eventually is thrown into prison. But the reason he's thrown into prison is because of Potiphar's wife. Let's go look in, I think it's verse 6. Yeah, it says, well, basically he left everything in his care. And then it says, now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns is entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? See, Joseph had taken the time to build up a moral intelligence. He knew what was right and he knew what was wrong. And he also had disciplined himself. You know, I mean, this is such a common temptation. I mean, many people, you know, I would hate to even be in this spot, and I would like to think I'm strong enough, but my gosh, you know, here he is. He's a young man. He's not married. You know, he's all of this is just thrown in his face. But the discipline he demonstrates here. And we know he's prudent because everything's been placed in his care. Then in verse 10, and though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or to even be with her. That is prudence. Not only did he not go to bed with her, he refused to even be with her. See, he's making the right choice. He's not putting himself even in a situation where that's going to be a possibility. I think of the story of Billy Graham, who, you know, he relates publicly how, he just wanted to completely eliminate the possibility of sin with a woman. And so he asked all of his men that were around him to help him in this area, to make sure that he didn't fall down as many men of God and pastors have. Billy Graham, the story, and I don't know if it's true, but I think it is, that he would not even get on an elevator if he was by himself with another woman. See, that's a Joseph principle. It's prudence. He knew he had a weakness. He recognized it, and then he took steps to prevent it. But the moral intelligence is building up in you what is the right thing to do. It leads me right next to what I call emotional intelligence. See, Billy Graham had a moral intelligence. He knew the right thing to do. But the emotional intelligence was recognizing that he had a weakness in this area and that he could succumb easily to it. I remember years ago where my good friend, Mark called me actually. And it was a morning, I was on the West Coast, and when Mark called me, I rehearsed to him that, you know, he asked what's going on, and I told him over a series of days I had been having these dreams. Well, the dreams were sexual in nature, and they had been very bothersome. But finally, on the last series of days where I had this dream, I actually sinned in my dream. Well, when Mark is talking to me, you know, asking me what's going on, I told him, I said, well, you know, I don't really have a problem in this area and blah, 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 blah. And then Mark got really quiet and he said, Gallagher, you're really starting to concern me. And I'm thinking, why, Mark? I haven't done anything. He said, you know, you're just talking with bravado here concerning the attack of the enemy and don't ever discount the devil. Well, I learned a very valuable lesson in that. You know, the fact of the matter is, I do have a problem in that area. And every man has a problem in the area, in the sense of a potential problem. And that takes emotional intelligence to recognize that. No, I don't actively have a problem, and I would hope that none of you do too. But we all have the potential for sinning in this area. A person of emotional intelligence is someone who's in touch with and connected to the areas of their life that could potentially cause them problems. You know, the other day, my wife Lori and I were talking, and she brought up an example. I asked her if I could use it, and she said, of course. So I'd like to relate this to you because recently I was traveling. Well, my wife Lori, years ago when she was a teenager, had a problem with eating. She was a binge eater and then she would purge. I believe we would call that bulimia. Well, when I travel and Lori's alone and of the normal stresses and pressures of life, she tends to have thoughts that could come back that, you know, take comfort in food and it would lead her to binge eating again. She's feeling disconnected and kind of needy. And what she's doing is because of the lies and some of the things the devil has sown into her heart when she was a little kid, then see, she seeks to alleviate the distress that's going on. And so she would seek pleasure in food. Well, so what did Lori do about it? Well, she told me how, you know, the day was really tough. She kept thinking and having these recurring thoughts throughout the day. So when nighttime rolled around and it was time for the bed with the three kids, she put the kids in bed and she went to bed herself. She consciously said, you know what? I'm not going to stay up and be alone because if I do, I'll eat. So I'm going to go to bed. That is prudence. That is wisdom in action. That is exactly what I'm talking about. She knew, you know, she had moral intelligence. She knew what was the right and fair and just and good path that she should take. And she had emotional intelligence to understand enough of the feelings and the things that were going on inside of her. That's emotional intelligence. It's being in touch with what we're feeling and then tracing it back to trying to discover why we're feeling that way. And then prudence is making the right choice, consciously choosing to walk on that right path. Something in order for us to have emotional intelligence that I've found I've had to get in touch with is the fact that I have a shadow self. Fact is, we all have a shadow self. You know, not a single one of us can walk out into the world and not have a shadow. And as I think about this, we all have a public self. Everybody, you know, that would know who I am knows who I am publicly. And then there's another side of me that my friends and intimate friends might know me in a deeper way. And then there's another aspect of my visible self that only my wife would possibly know, you know, my struggles or other areas of my life. But then there's a shadow side to me that nobody knows. Nobody knows the shadow Dan. But there is a shadow, and we all have a shadow self. As I've gotten in touch with the parts of me that are parts of my shadow, it has helped me to develop more emotional intelligence and to be more prudent. For example, I come from a family, a long line of alcoholism in my family. My father at one time struggled with alcoholism. He did conquer it later in life. I have other family members who struggle with alcoholism. I've got cousins on both sides of my family, my mother's and my father's side, who are alcoholic. And so there is a shadow to me, a shadow Dan, that I call Alcoholic Dan. I've never been an alcoholic. I've never, you know, had alcohol out of control. But I recognize that in my shadow self, there is a strong possibility that I could. I know that when I work hard and come in and have a beer at night, which I don't do very frequently, but if I did that a number of nights in a row, I begin to feel a craving coming on and seeking that alcoholic drink. So I label part of me as there's Alcohol Dan, but it's a shadow self. I look at him and I say, "You have no power over me," because I have enjoyed sobriety my whole life and I will not yield to the shadow Dan. In the same way, there's an immoral Dan that I believe God was calling attention to and helping me to see. Be careful, don't let the devil tempt you in this way, which Mark helped me to identify. If we're going to walk and be prudent, we're going to have to accept all the aspects of our lives. We're going to have to recognize the shadow self. How do you get rid of a shadow? Well, of course, you bring it to the light. But it's not just any light. If the light is in the center of the room and I'm on the edge of the room, the shadow isn't as bright as when I draw closer to the light. In other words, the shadow gets darker the closer I get to the light. Now, the shadow may decrease and diminish in some way, but it shortens. But it gets almost darker. The only way to eliminate our shadows is to bring them directly under the light. Then the shadow is completely under your feet. And the light, God, and his Son, Jesus Christ, is where we need to stand, perfectly aligned with his light. Then we're morally upright. The epitome of moral uprightness is holiness. That's the virtue ultimately that we're pursuing. And when we pursue holiness, we increase in prudence. We increase in being able to know the right, the fair, and the just path. As we continue to seek prudence, to do the right thing in the right way, at the right time, we will see that we increase in holiness and we're going to increase in effectiveness and power in our lives for Jesus Christ. Prudence is the art of learning to do the next right thing. It's what God wants us to do. He desires for us to be prudent. We have an obligation to do it.
The teaching you just heard was a presentation of Spirit and Truth Fellowship International. For further study, we encourage you to visit our research website, truthortradition.com. If you would like to get your copy of this teaching on CD or tape, you can go online at our home website, stfonline.org/store, or call us toll-free at 888-255-6189. Again, that's 888-255-6189. God bless you.